Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Generation Y ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible. Starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500.
Welcome, everyone. This is Aaron. On this episode, I will be interviewing Mike Morford of Criminology Podcast. His second season has been all about the Golden State Killer. And as you know, the news is that they've caught him. And by they, I mean the authorities. Joseph James DeAngelo Jr., 72 years old, former Navy man, former police officer, was arrested at 2:30 in the morning on Wednesday. He is 5'11 and weighs 205 pounds. DNA evidence is what changed this case. He was not on anyone's radar. But yet, when you look at the profile of the killer, he fits it to a T.
This is your last chance to save 65% on a full year of BODi. I'm Carl, co-founder of BODi. That's B-O-D-I. And I want to help you lean into your decision to start working out and eating better. Right now, if you sign up for a one-year subscription to BODi, I'll give you 65% off. Look, I know it's not easy to get fit and lose weight, especially if you're trying to figure it out by yourself. But we make it simple. Just follow a program for 20 to 30 minutes day by day and lose 5 to 10 pounds a month. We have over 120 programs that have been tested and proven to work, and almost 300,000 five-star reviews in the App Store to prove it. BODi also has complete eating plans and thousands of healthy, delicious recipes. So stop guessing and start seeing results with BODi. And let me give you 65% off right now so you save big on the app that CNN underscored named Best Fitness App. But the sale ends this week, so don't wait. Sign up for a year of BODi and save 65%. Just go to BODi.com. That's B-O-D-I with an I.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Mike, welcome back.
How you doing tonight, Aaron?
Once I read the news, the whole day just shot up into the stratosphere.
Yeah, it was a pretty big day in true crime.
Let me start by saying the original Night Stalker, a.k.a. East Area Rapist, a.k.a. Golden State Killer, was probably, in North America anyway, I would say the most notorious killer who had evaded capture and identification.
Yeah, I think he's probably California's worst serial predator, if not, you know, in the United States, the worst predator that there's been.
And as you know, the Zodiac Killer is up there as well. But when we're talking about the impact, it's hard to beat this one.
Yeah, the Zodiac, you know, essentially attacked from 1968 to 1969. And then after that, he sort of disappeared and wrote a bunch of letters. But from a victim standpoint, he didn't really claim that many victims. Whereas the East Area Rapist, Golden State Killer, original Night Stalker, from 1976 to 1986, he had 12 murder victims, 50 rape victims, hundreds of home break-ins and burglaries. And, you know, it's come to light that he most likely was also the Visalia Ransacker, which I think is going to be coming out, which is a whole nother series of crimes that he's going to be linked to, including a murder. So he's going to have a lot of stats when it's all said and done.
There might be some people listening to this who don't really remember the case that well. So as a refresher, what would you tell them? What is this killer's MO?
Well, the East Area Rapist MO is essentially to terrorize people, to sexually attack them and demoralize them and gain power over them. And from the very beginning in 1976, in June, when he attacked in Sacramento County, until he finished in 1986 in Orange County, he was into, you know, various aspects of tying people up. If they didn't cooperate, he threatened to kill them. He'd go through their stuff. He'd eat the food out of the refrigerator and, you know, place dishes on the backs of husbands and boyfriends and tell them that if they moved and tried to escape, that he would kill them. So it was sort of a game to him, to where he wanted to terrorize people and scare them. He would call them before and after the attack sometimes and threaten them and make obscene phone calls and just to scare them. I mean, in one case, he called somebody 24 years after her attack. So it's been a case of where that's his primary goal, is to scare people, to put fear into them. And that was his MO. You know, at the time, he would do minor burglaries and steal small items out of their house, but that wasn't his primary goal. You know, he wanted to scare people. He wanted to attack them. And that's what he did most of the time.
One thing that I remember when we covered this case was the fact that he would shine a light into people's eyes. And at this point, it's late at night, they're asleep, and then there's suddenly a bright light shining at them. And there's this masked figure who's barking commands at them. I mean, what a frightening thing to know that there's suddenly someone in the room with you and they've gained entry without your knowing it.
Yeah. And you can't be any more vulnerable than sound asleep and have somebody wake you up with a flashlight in your eyes and a gun pointed at you. It's very hard to get the upper hand in that situation. So from the very beginning, he had them at a severe disadvantage. And, you know, he used that to his advantage. You know, hey, I'm going to blow your heads off if you don't do what I say. I mean, there's very few options that you can do in that situation. And, you know, that's what he did again and again and again. And he always targeted people like that. And, you know, if it was a lone female that he was attacking, he usually only used a knife to go after them. If it was a male that he was attacking in the house and there were two people, he would use a gun and he would try and avoid getting close to the male victims. And he would order the female victim to tie up the male victim because he didn't want to get too close to him. And then he would tie up the female victim. So this was sort of a script that he had, and it was pretty steady along the entire series of his 50 rapes.
This is a sophisticated criminal because he not only was able to scope out the place that he would be robbing, but he would know about the victims. He would know where a gun was kept. I mean, he seemed to understand the entire environment that he was entering into, and he would enter into it more than once.
Yeah, there were instances when people would find their home broken into, but they couldn't find anything missing. You know, a lot of times it was because he wanted to walk around in their homes. Sometimes they would find things burglarized, but they were minor things. And then there was evidence where he was looking for stuff, taking pictures, not taking anything valuable. You know, most burglars, when they go into a house, they want to carry as much valuable stuff out as fast as they can and then get out of there. But this guy liked to go in and snoop around and spend time in their living space going through their personal items. And it was, you know, something that came up again and again. That was something that he was into.
I said that he was sophisticated. What kind of intelligence do you think he has? Because if you look at the impact that he had, how many homes he robbed, how many people he was able to rape or murder and get away with it for that long, just the scope of it seems overwhelming. What do you think about his intelligence, just based on what you know?
I think it's hard to say how intelligent he was. He was very, I don't know what the right word would be, but very vigilant about where he was attacking, who was attacking, when he was attacking them, what defenses they might have, what escape routes he would have. I think he spent a lot of time stalking people, surveilling them, checking out the places he was going to be entering ahead of time. So it's somebody that had a laser sharp focus on the areas that he was going to attack, and he used that to his advantage. And this is a case where the evidence seems to suggest that he wasn't necessarily picking out women to target. He was picking out areas and homes to target. And if something happened, things didn't go right, and he had abort an attack on one victim, he would simply go to a house a couple houses over and wind up raping a woman there. So I think it's shows that he was very mission-oriented, and he would stick to a plan, and if something wasn't going right, he would just go to a different location.
So maybe not intelligence, but at least his mind was tuned for this.
He was all about the stakeout, the preliminary monitoring, I guess you would say, of the victims, the areas. He would call the people ahead of time and call them afterwards. So it showed a continued feed for him to certain areas, to certain victims. And, you know, a lot of times when one person was attacked, they would find out that three or four different neighbors in the same neighborhood were getting hang up phone calls ahead of time. And these were likely from him. So it shows the level of stalking and planning that he did, and going as far as to get several different neighbors' phone numbers and call them and terrorize them too.
You've already talked about how fear was a big part of this. And obviously the calls must be another way to get that fear out of these victims, as he would probably consider them. How did he manage to do all of that? Were these people just listed in a phone book?
Some of the people were listed in phone books. Some of them weren't. But back in some of the older phone books, they had cross street directories to where you could look at a street address in the phone directory and just look at the address and see who lived at that address and what the phone number was. So you could look up their phone number the way you normally would, or you could look it up by their street address. So that's one way he possibly did it. Another way was the older phones back then used to have the phone numbers for the home embossed right on the phone itself, on the old rotary phones. And if he's in there prowling and breaking in ahead of time, he can probably look right down on that phone and see a phone number there. So although, you know, once we now know who this guy was, who he turned out to be, then it makes it possible there were other ways that he could have gotten the phone number as well.
There's this escalation that happens over time. We think he's the ransacker. He was the East Area Rapist. Do you believe that there are people that just never came forward?
Well, typically rape is a very underreported crime. There's people that just, they're ashamed. They don't want to go through the further, you know, terror of having to be probed and checked out and tested and everything else that goes along with that. And it's like a second humiliation to them. So a lot of times rapes aren't reported. And I don't know what the statistics on that are, but, you know, if he raped 50 people that came forward and they're attributed to him, there's a good chance there's several more out there that for whatever reason didn't come forward, or they weren't somehow linked to the case. But there's a good bet that he has other victims out there.
What are the statistics here? Let's just say they're half. Let's say only half report. And I bet that's not even true. I bet it's far less. But if you think about just even half, there could be 100 out there.
Yeah, that's the truth. And it's scary because, you know, how many different areas did he attack? And, you know, when he attacked in 1976 in June, his first confirmed victim, it was 6 months after the Visalia Ransacker attack stopped. In that attack, in the Visalia Ransacker, you know, break-ins and burglaries, he didn't rape. That wasn't his primary motive. He wasn't looking to rape people. 6 months later, he shows up at his first confirmed rape scene, and he's highly skilled and has a detailed plan and goes through it like he's done it before. So it makes you wonder if during that 6 month span, if there were other people that he started off with in rapes, and how come they've never been identified.
Well, I would imagine he's probably told a number of people, don't tell anyone. Isn't that possible?
Yeah. And it could be, if you tell anybody, I'll come back and I'll kill you. Or it's just, it comes down to, you know, again, the shame, the humiliation they felt, they didn't want to come forward. Or it could have been just an altogether completely different area that he was in, that somehow the rapes weren't attributed to him. And it was just, it looked like a random rapist that had come through and raped somebody. But by the time he showed up in June of 76 with his first confirmed East Area rapist attack, he looked like he knew what he was doing.
The number one question I've seen, at least from what I'm reading, people want to know, why did he stop, if he stopped? And it seems like he did.
I mean, that could be any number of different reasons. You know, originally, when his last confirmed murder happened in 1986, the one before that was 1981. So people said, hey, what's with this 5-year gap? Could he have been in prison? Did he move away? Did he get stationed someplace in the military? There were all these rumors. But it came out recently that multiple victims received phone calls during that 81 to 86 timeframe. And that shows that he wasn't in jail. He was calling these victims, still terrorizing them during that time. But also importantly, with the suspect that was just arrested, he had daughters that were born in 1981 and 1986 during those 2 years when he had that hiatus and he had attacked in 81 and 86. So it's going to be interesting to see if that had something to do with his motivation for attacking those 2 years.
Have you heard from anyone who was able to tell you anything about what he might have said since he's been captured? Has he admitted to doing anything? Has he been tied to the Ransacker case?
Well, I did hear a source tell me directly, a reliable source, that they're 99.9% sure he was the Visalia Ransacker. And I think the reason that extra percent isn't there, to that 0.1% isn't there, is because they probably don't have DNA to conclusively say it's him. But he was living in Tulare County, where the Visalia Ransacker crimes were happening during that time. So it's a good possibility, you know, and what he looks like was similar to the Ransacker sketch. So it's a good possibility that he was living there and he was the Visalia Ransacker, and police feel that he was as well.
Do you believe his hunting grounds are tied to where he was living at the time?
I used to believe that, and now I sort of don't. I was under the impression that he lived very close to the first and the third East Area rapist attacks, because in both of those attacks, in the first and the third one, they were in Rancho Cordova, very close to each other. And at both crime scenes, he either arrived or left nude from the waist down. And to me, that told me that he was very close to his house and probably could sprint there if he needed to get away, to hide, to take cover. But come to find out where this suspect lived at, I haven't found any address histories very close to those locations. He lived a little bit further out on the outskirts of Sacramento County. So that's going to be interesting to see if they can tie him closer to some of these victims. But so far, from what I've seen, he doesn't have a very close proximity to most of the victims.
Well, it's interesting that he had escalation. He went from robbery to raping and then to murder, and then he stopped. But as you said, he was still making phone calls. When was the last time that we know that he called someone?
He called somebody in 2001, and that victim, again, it's 24 years after she was raped. She was confident that the person that called her was her rapist. But the interesting thing was, when he called her a day or two before he called her, there had been news that came out that was circulated around California that the DNA from the East Area Rapist in Northern California was linked to the murders in Southern California. So that didn't apparently scare him. In fact, it made him reach out and contact one of his victims. And maybe at the time he didn't really understand what the DNA meant. But he never did call again after that.
Yeah, it's really curious that we didn't know until 2001 that these two criminals were actually the same person.
Yeah, and that's the frightening part, because people in Northern California that knew this guy as the East Area Rapist had no idea about the original Night Stalker down in Southern California, and vice versa. You know, they didn't know about each other. Although, you know, Larry Crompton is one of the detectives that was heavily involved in the Northern California Contra Costa County investigating. He suspected heavily that the Southern California crimes were the work of the East Area Rapist, but he couldn't prove it because they didn't have DNA. They, you know, at the time DNA wasn't a thing. He just had a gut feeling, and the MO was very similar. Some of the bindings were done the same way. He approached the victims the same way. So he felt all along that this guy was striking, raping and killing people down in Southern California, but he didn't have a way to prove it until the DNA later came along and then confirmed his hunch. And from there, it was connected.
We had sketches of this guy. We had descriptions. And we also had a police officer who almost got him. What was it about him that we couldn't get a real gauge on his age? I mean, when I looked into this case, I really felt like he was younger, a teenager. And I had a lot of people telling me, no, I doubt he's a teenager. Well, it turns out he wasn't. But the officer who looked at him really felt like he was really young. But is that because the officer was just that much older? He couldn't really gauge his age because of maybe, you know, maybe he did have some baby fat in his face still and he had a higher pitched voice.
Well, it's hard to say. And even in the recording, some of the recordings that they think might be him, he sounds like a feminine voice. He was soft-spoken. A lot of times he was growling through clenched teeth and trying to make his voice sound different. So I think he sounded younger. And just about every victim that I've read reports on in the case described him as sounding as if he was in his 20s. And I also believed he was in his 20s. But, you know, a lot of people have pointed out, you know, something that makes sense. A younger offender, 17, 18, 19, 20-year-old kid, wouldn't have the determination, the drive, the wherewithal to put a plan together constantly and stick to it. And I think that makes a lot of sense in hindsight, that an older person doing these crimes, such as he was at the time, he was, you know, almost 30 years old, he did have that kind of, wherewithal and determination to carry that out. And that makes a little bit more sense to me. But between the, you know, the Visalia ransacker, when the police officer was shot at by him, he actually was reluctant to shoot the ransacker because he thought he was a young kid. He said he had a baby face. It didn't look like he shaved, I think was the word that he used to describe the guy. So I think that was part of it, you know, between the way he looked and sounded. I think that's primarily why a lot of people thought he was in his 20s.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly, or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. And immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better, notice things like your hair and your nails, feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
When these cases go cold, and this one definitely did, it seems like some cases are fortunate where there are people who are driven to keep the case in the public eye and even in the public ear, and it's like they won't let it go. And in this case, we had a number of people who devoted a lot of time and really worked to educate the public about it, hoping for a break one day. Can you talk about, you know, some of these people like Debbie Domingo or Michelle McNamara?
Yeah. So, you know, even before talking about them, you know, some of the original investigators, you know, from out of Sacramento County, Carol Daly, Richard Shelby up in Contra Costa County, Larry Crompton, you know, these people retired 20, 30 years ago now, but they were so driven to see this case solved that, you know, they're up in age, they're 70s, 80 years old now, and they're still out there on TV, you know, talking about what they saw, what they heard, what they learned, how they missed them, and what things they would have done over again. And that's, you know, for them to continue to help hunt this guy 20, 30 years after they retired tells you about their determination. But in talking about the victims or the family members of victims, you know, Michelle Cruz, her sister Janelle was murdered in 1986. You know, Debbie Domingo, her mom, Sherry, was murdered, and her boyfriend, Greg, was murdered in 1981. They continue to just keep spreading the word, telling their story. And it's got to be hard to bring up those things that are so difficult to remember and painful, yet they get the courage to somehow keep talking about it, which is one of the things I really find admirable, that they, in an effort to see the case solved, they were willing to do that and continuously go through that pain to help spread awareness and see this guy caught.
When I was at CrimeCon in 2017, I got to meet some of those ladies, and they're just fantastic. I mean, they're coming up to thank me, and I'm thinking, you know, if it wasn't for you, this case could have slipped away. And I understand what you're saying about detectives who had retired and are still working the case, but sometimes we don't have that connection. Sometimes there's a grassroots effort, that connection where you read something and you feel it, the importance of this case. And you really look it over, and I feel like this is a case that should have been even bigger than it was. And I think it's really, really getting the attention it deserves now because they finally caught him.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's been, over the last 18 to 24 months probably, it's been getting a lot more attention. I mean, there's, you know, a few podcasts have done, you know, shows about it, you know, yours, mine, a couple other ones, Case File. But there's documentaries, there's TV shows, there's Michelle McNamara's book, and Michelle really did a lot to bring this case to the public, you know, to help link it in the public's consciousness, because, you know, she had a way with law enforcement that she was able to talk to them, get information, and then was able to share it in her writing and her, you know, use her voice to make this case more well known than it was. And she's the one that coined the Golden State Killer term. So she gave him that moniker, and, you know, it's sort of stuck, and that's what most people refer to him as now. But, you know, just using her voice to help spread awareness to this case was pretty admirable too.
Now, your podcast originally started out covering the Zodiac Killer case, and then you came back, and this is Criminology Podcast. It came back season two, and you were covering this case.
Yes, season one was the Zodiac, and you know, I had done a lot of research and stuff on that one. I had a background with that one, so that was an easy one to start off with. But coming into this case, I wasn't as familiar with, and it was actually Michelle McNamara that had, you know, we exchanged emails, and, you know, I wrote an article that went on her blog, and we'd bounce ideas around for different cases we were both interested in, but she really got hooked on this case, and she had asked me, you know, at some point if I was interested in helping to research it, and at the time I wasn't, but I just didn't have enough time. But, you know, she passed away, and then I wound up, you know, sort of diving in headfirst after that, and you know, it's what I pretty much been doing constantly for the last couple, 2.5 years. But, you know, there's a big awareness on it now that has been on there for the last 2 years, I think. And, you know, it's really grown in popularity, and people in California, in Southern California, didn't know who the East Area Rapist was. And up in Northern California, they didn't know who the original Night Stalker was, you know. So Michelle, by connecting them for, as the Golden State Killer, was able to combine both of them to something, you know, that people could understand. And now it's, you know, a national thing. It's got national attention. So the focus on this case has really gone well. And it, you know, it made sense for us to cover this in the second season because I had access to a lot of stuff and a lot of people. And, you know, everybody was willing to pitch in and lend a hand to help this season happen. So that's how we wound up doing this season of Criminology, focusing on the Golden State Killer.
Is it known, you know, how they got this break? Because so many people have been looking into this. We know Michelle McNamara had the detectives who were working the case. They had these sketches, which they seemed all a little different. But what was the break here? What happened to turn this from a cold case into solved?
Well, from what I've heard, and again, I don't have any specific information, but I've heard that it happened pretty quickly over the last 5, 6, 7 days. And when it got going pretty fast, and they worked it, and, you know, they had reason to suspect whatever reason that this guy was the guy, and they staked him out, and they were able to get something he discarded in the trash or whatever. And they immediately tested it, fast tracked it, and got a quick response that it was 100% East Area Rapist DNA. So they moved in and arrested him, and it sort of went very quickly. But I don't know what the source was. I've heard different things that there's been some rumors that there was a tip after one of the shows aired. Somebody started thinking it might be this guy. There's been a rumor that one of his own daughters submitted her DNA. But from the common thing that I've heard from some people that I trust is that they had worked some different DNA techniques that they had. And I think they probably linked to his family and figured out who his family was. And then from there, I think they just went down the line and looked at every family member until they got to this guy and found out that he fit the profile on paper as far as locations, description, and all that stuff. I think that's how they probably arrived at this guy.
Right. Thinking about the bindings and things like that, there was this idea. I mean, he could have been in the Navy, and he's an ex-Navy guy. So many things line up. And then he was also a police officer for 6 years, right?
Yeah, he was a police officer, and he got let go in 1979 for shoplifting. And one of the things he shoplifted was dog repellent, which I had no idea what that was. I had to look that up because it's, you know, it's not something I typically would hear, but it's just what it sounds like. It's for keeping dogs away, and I guess it's got a bad odor or something that dogs don't like, you know, which fits right in with what the East Area Rapist would probably want. He doesn't want dogs attacking him or chasing him at these crime scenes. So if he's got that, he can keep these dogs at a distance. Or, you know, possibly the bloodhounds that are going to track him after the crimes, maybe he wants to throw them off, so he's got this dog repellent, who knows. But after that shoplifting incident, when he was let go, was 1979. That's when the rapes up in Northern California stopped and the rapes and murders in Southern California started.
There have been many clues over the years with this case, certain things that we know that he took from homes, things that he said. Were there any clues that ended up really mattering now. And when we look back, we say, yeah, that does tie in. We see how that ties in now. Anything that stands out to you in that way?
The one interesting thing that I did find was that a couple people reported him sobbing at crime scenes. He was over in the corner sobbing. It sounded like he was crying, saying, I don't want to do this anymore. And some of the, you know, some of the victims felt that he was being legitimate, that he wasn't putting that on, that it was a real emotion. Now, I've since heard some experts say that a person of this guy's mental faculties doesn't notice, doesn't recognize pain. He doesn't have empathy for somebody. So he wouldn't cry about something he's done to them, which to me, you know, sort of makes sense when looking at it that way. But one of the things that he did do when he cried some of these times, the victims thought he said, Bonnie doesn't like it when I do this. Or he would mention the name Bonnie in the middle of these crying spells. Well, one thing I did find that was interesting was in 1970, this guy was engaged to a woman named Bonnie. And they didn't wind up getting married. 2 or 3 years later, they both married different people. But I found it interesting that her name was Bonnie. And he, you know, the East Area rapist apparently said Bonnie at a couple different crime scenes.
So what does that mean to you if he's possibly struggling with Bonnie doesn't like this? Does love factor into what he's doing or not doing?
You know, I couldn't even tell you. I think that would take probably somebody that was some training into the human mind to go down that road, because it's either legitimate and he's really sorry for what he's doing and he, for whatever reason, he's bringing up Bonnie, or it's fake and he's just doing that to throw people off and make them seem like he's some person different than he really is, and he just chose her name because it was somebody that he knew. I don't know. But it would be interesting to find out, you know, what some mental health experts would have to say about the use of that name and the connection to her.
Right. But I was also just thinking, if we can look at his past and see when he got married, once we learn more about him, we might be able to put together a timeline where we can see if, depending on how his home life is, whether there are less attacks or any attacks. I mean, we have that gap of time where maybe he wasn't operating, at least physically. I mean, he was still making phone calls, but maybe he wasn't actually going out anywhere.
Well, there are some gaps. Now, like, for example, 1973, the woman he did marry, who wasn't Bonnie, was a different woman. In the record of the marriage, he's listed as living in Tulare County, which is where Visalia is, and the woman he married was listed as living in the Sacramento area. So that right there says that he could be the Visalia ransacker because he's living in the right county and it's the right time when these burglaries are going on there. But later on, once he's the East Area rapist, there are some interesting gaps of time. You know, there's a couple spans where there's like 2 to 3 month intervals with no attacks. During December through February of 1977 into 78, there's a span of a couple months where there's no attacks, but he's using the phone an awful lot to attack people over the phone. So it'd be interesting to see if something happened to him or in his life back in that time frame of December of 77 to February of 78, if something happened that kept him in the house where he couldn't go out and attack people, but he still needed to terrorize them over the phone. So that'll be something interesting to see what they find as far as that gap goes.
I'm really curious to learn whether they find a bunch of souvenirs in his home.
Yeah, that's definitely interesting. It'll be, you know, a lot of people, you know, experts feel that these guys do save trophies and things to remind them of what happened. You know, BTK did that. Other killers have done that. So it would be interesting, you know, to see if he does have that stuff. He, you know, the FBI was cleaning out his house pretty thoroughly, you know, some of the video that I saw. So in several instances, he would take single earrings of victims. just little things. Usually they weren't very expensive items. They were just little mementos. Some cases he would take only photographs. So not the things that typical burglars would take. In one of the later crimes, in one of the murders in Irvine, he took a cassette out of the answering machine, which who knows why he did it. Maybe his voice was on it and he didn't want people to hear that he had called the victim. Or maybe he took it because the victim's voice was on there and he wanted to play that back and hear her voice again. Who knows? But that's just some of the stuff that he took that, you know, most of the time they're not valuable to anybody else. You know, his ultimate goal is that terror. I mean, I don't think that was ever in doubt. The, you know, the rape is part of the terror, but it's not, you know, probably his main, you know, sexual thing that sets him off. It's the actual control, the fear. That's what he is motivated by. That's where he gets his sexual, you know, pleasure from. You know, he's a sadist. So the fear and suffering of the victims is something that's sexually appealing to him. At one crime scene in Santa Barbara, when he killed the couple, he bludgeoned Sherry Domingo. He masturbated onto her body and ejaculated on her body, even though she was already dead. He didn't rape her. But it just goes to show you that, you know, what's going through this guy's mind, that bludgeoning somebody and seeing their dead body on the bed was something that was sexually appealing to him. So I think most normal people out there, it's unfathomable. You know, it's not something that people can comprehend, but for him, it's what drove him. It's the thing that made him a monster, you know, where most people would never venture down that trail.
Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Quince. Do you need to upgrade your wardrobe or home essentials at an unbeatable price? Well, Quince has you covered with timeless pieces that never go out of style, and you'll have them in your closet forever. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% off less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman, passes the savings on to you, and Quince only works with factories that are safe, ethical, with responsible manufacturing practices. Along with premium fabrics and finishes, how can you not love that? I recently got a duvet cover and a pair of awesome relaxed jeans. They're stretchy too. You can find all kinds of stuff at Quince. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/GenY for free shipping on your first order and 365-day returns. That's Quince, Quince.com/GenY to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/GenY.
Who is in charge of this case?
Well, you know, it's a tricky case because there's so many counties involved. Sacramento, where most of the rapes happened, they had rapes, and up until recently, they didn't have the Maggiore's, who were the young military couple that was killed in 1978. They weren't official Easter rapist victims until recently. So at the time, they were just rapes in Sacramento, and when the statute of limitations ran out, they destroyed their evidence because they couldn't prosecute anybody, even if they came forward and admitted they did it. But by doing so, you know, rape kits and everything else, any kind of physical evidence went out the window too. So they had no DNA left. The DNA is in Contra Costa County, Orange County, Santa Barbara, Ventura. The other counties had DNA and they preserved them, and that's what links the crimes together. But that being said, now, you know, the Maggiore's are considered murder victims there. So even they don't have DNA in the case, they're still part of the series and they're still connected. So when they got this information, being that the suspect lived in Sacramento County, you know, Sacramento County is primarily who moved in and apprehended him. But I think as far as who's in charge, that's a little bit trickier because everybody's sort of working together. What I understand is when it comes to ultimately prosecuting this guy for his crimes, they're going to try and send most everything through Orange County. I don't know all the specifics behind that, but for whatever reason, that I think it's possibly because that's where most of the murder victims are. But the first charges they've made so far against this guy are, you know, for the 1980 Ventura murders of the Smiths and the 1978 murders of the Maggiores in Sacramento County. But there's going to be other murders that are going to be charged against this guy, and they're going to be in Santa Barbara County and Orange County.
When someone like this is arrested, they need to have some charges to put him away for now. They need to hold him. And then, of course, they'll work on whatever additional charges there will be. But I can't even imagine how many charges they can level against this guy just based on the DNA.
Yeah, it's going to be hard for this guy to get out of, you know, some of these charges because his DNA is there. It's not just at one, it's at several. So it's going to be hard for him to say, hey, it's an accident that it's there. You know, this is 100% DNA connected. There's no doubt it's his. So, you know, obviously it's the legal system and all kinds of crazy things can happen until the sentence is handed down. You know, nothing's in stone, but this is pretty much, I think, an ironclad case as there's going to be. So in my opinion, this guy is never going to see freedom again.
Being a part of this true crime community, we're all over the place. You know, each of us has our own pet cases that we really like to follow up on. This is the kind of case, though, that was so big that when it broke, everybody turned and just focused on it. I mean, all the posts today. I mean, what is this like for you? I can't imagine what it'd be like if they suddenly had a DNA break in that case.
Well, the Zodiac case, I don't think is going to be solved. I think that's just too old. I don't think they have good evidence. I think any good suspects are dead. So I've accepted the fact that I don't think it's going to be solved. This case was different. They had so much evidence in so many places, and it was an offender that was probably younger than the Zodiac. I knew there was a very good chance this was going to get solved, and his DNA technology advanced, I felt this was going to get solved. So I always had a good feeling about this. But when I heard about it, it was surreal. You know, as a matter of fact, we were recording last night, episode 10 of the season of 12 episodes. And about three quarters of the way through the show, I got a text, and it was somebody that I don't know very well that I have a connection with that said the Easter rapist has been arrested. And I've heard that 1,000 times. So I went to a source that I trust that gets back to me very quickly. And, you know, I said, is it true? I heard you got the Easter rapist in custody. And usually if I ask him something like that, he'll laugh and say, hey, you're crazy. Except this time he didn't laugh. He sent a smiley face back. So I knew it was a gut feeling that he was in custody. And then I checked with another source that gave me more information, and then I talked to a family member of a victim, and we were just sort of, it was a surreal moment because we've been trying to get to this point where it's solved, and to know that it was solved, we just didn't know what to do with it. We didn't know how to process it. You know, I was exchanging messages with Paul Haynes, who finished Michelle McNamara's book, along with Billy Jensen, and last night, we're sending messages back and forth, and we were just, neither of us could believe it. We were just sort of blown away. You know, we wanted to get to this point, but now we're here, and it's almost like it's not real. So it's been a weird 24 hours. You know, I think I got 2 hours of sleep last night. But it's been a good thing. And I think sort of what you touched on in the true crime community, I think people rally around things. You know, just the other day, it was like the Bible and Freeman case got solved, and, you know, the abduction and murders of those two young girls that has been popular for so many years. And then this one, I mean, it's just, you know, the good news in such a bleak, you know, unfortunately, it's usually bleak genre. To get good news, I think people rally around that and help support it. And I think that's sort of what happened when news broke today about this.
Right. And we're all interested in justice. And it feels like this case will finally see justice.
Yeah, that's the thing. And again, when you mentioned, you know, hearing about Debbie's experiences, and, you know, when I was at CrimeCon last year and you talked to them, you know, you seeing how determined they were, when we did the presentation on stage for the panel there, when we went back and were at the booth handing out literature material, the people were just coming up and saying, I can't believe this happened to you. I'm so mad. And other people were coming up crying. And I was blown away. I mean, I'd never seen anything like that, to see strangers coming up crying for these women. So it really floored me, and it left me determined to do whatever I could to help see this case solved. And I think that whole, you know, CrimeCon example was just a portion of how the true crime community in general is, to where people want to see justice and they want to see bad guys go down, and see justice done. And I think that's evidence of what's happened so far.
Thank you for coming on, Mike. And I know you're the first person I thought of to contact. I also thought of Billy Jensen later, but I really wanted to speak with you because we've talked a number of times in the past. And I know this case has been something that really, you've really turned your focus onto it. And that doesn't surprise me, because in some ways it was a big mystery, just like the Zodiac, although a completely different kind of mystery. But with all the different suspects, with the sketches, there's something here, I guess, like what you talked about earlier, about how this felt like it could be solved. And now it's solved, it seems like. So it's something that people worked on for years, and it's finally come to an end. Although I guess now we have the court stuff coming up, or a plea, however it turns out. Anything you'd like to leave the listeners with?
No, I think we've touched on everything. I would say that I think this is proof that when something looks hopeless, when something, years have gone by and there's no progress, and it just seems like nothing is going to happen, and the case is done, then something out of the blue happens where people are working behind the scenes, still putting in as much effort as they can to catch somebody like this. I think it just gives hope to everybody out there that's got a pet case or a family member who was murdered, or a cold case that they're involved with that seems like it's hopeless. I think this is proof that, you know, even the worst offenders can be tracked down and face justice. And I think that should give people some hope.
So don't lose hope. And if you're thinking about writing a blog article on an unsolved case, do it, right? Get the word
out. Absolutely.
Just like True Crime Diary did back in the day.
Yeah, and that's still a good site, and that's a good spot to go and look at some old cases that don't get a lot of attention, that are loved ones to somebody, are still out there and unsolved, and deserve justice just as much as some of the bigger cases.
We let people know where to find you.
Yeah, so I'm on Twitter. You know, my own personal account is at True Crime Guy. Or for the podcast, Criminology Pod, they can find me there. And then, of course, we're on Facebook as well. Well,
always a pleasure to speak with you. And like I said, this is a great day. It boosted my mood, and I just never thought this day would come.
Yeah, I'm complete agreement, and I appreciate you having me on, Aaron. It's always fun talking to you.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Business can mean a lot of things. For some, it's earning reports, the top MBA program, investments, but business isn't everything we do. Side hustles that explode into the next billion-dollar company.
I need to create my own product that I control what the marketing is for.
Unconventional ideas that change the world we live in.
AI is everywhere, with venture capital pouring in.
From Elon Musk,
he took a massive axe and swung it through Twitter's workforce.
To Taylor Swift,
she is unstoppable as her Eras Tour stimulated local economy.
Your favorite coffee shop down the street, to the vacation house you rented last weekend. Whatever business means to you, Wondery is the destination for business podcasts. Listen to top business shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Everything from top daily news.
There was more ranch dressing sold last year than ketchup and barbecue sauce.
We're buying the dip, literally.
To deep dives on the biggest successes and failures of our time.
20,000 people lost their jobs.
Wondery means business.